Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for January's Orthopaedics Club webinar. I'm very pleased to introduce you to our speaker for today, veterinary specialist in the Small Animal Clinic, VetSwiss Faculty of Bern, Switzerland, Bianca Hetlick. Thank you, Bianca. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you, Ema, and thanks everyone for joining us for a practical approach to AA instability. Certainly not a topic that you or most of you will encounter very often, but nonetheless a problem that you may see or you may already have seen and not realized it. So I think for most of us in small animal practice that deal with a number of smaller dogs in particular, this is quite an important topic. So we will go through a number of things. And those will be review of why atlantoaxial instability occurs, then focus quite a bit on how to use radiography and other modalities for our diagnostic approach. We will talk about surgical repair. I know this may be more advanced than what you may be doing, but I think it's still important to have a good idea of what we can do for this disease and what the challenges are for atlantoaxial instability in regards to surgery. And then I'm going to spend a bit of time on cervical splinting, just a method that I found very useful in toy breed dogs and cats, actually, to immobilize the cervical spine, and wanted to share that with you and hopefully have that be, the main practical part of this talk. So a quick review of atlantoaxial anatomy. We have C1 and C2, so the atlas and the axis. The axis, remember, C2 has a dens, a forward-going process on the bottom of the vertebral canal. And this articulation also has no disc space. It has two very large articular facets on each side laterally. And then there are a good number of ligaments. There are multiple ligaments that cross over the dens and make sure that that stays in position on the floor of the vertebral canal. And then there is a very strong ligament between the dorsal lamina of C1 and the spinous process of C2, and that is the dorsal atlantoaxial ligament. So we have lots of ligamentous support, and we have a very, very special anatomy without a disc in the very cranial part of the cervical spine. On the image at the bottom right, what that image is trying to show is that we have, even in cats and dogs, quite a heavy head that then hinges onto quite a mobile and small spine. Through the nuchal ligament that attaches in cats and dogs on C2, from C2 on downwards, we have extra support. So C2 through C7 and then, of course, into the thorax, we have our strong cervical musculature, we have the nuchal ligament, and we have kind of a counteraction mechanism. And then cranial, we have the head. So you can imagine that these two structures, when there is abnormal movement going on or instability, will create a tremendous fulcrum, and that fulcrum is centered right at the C1, C2 articulation. This disease affects primarily small and toy breed dogs. Most of them are going to be young, and half of them, if not more, will be less than a year. So this is something that chances are you will see very, very early in a dog's life. Almost all of the affected dogs, these toy breed dogs, have an anomaly of the dens. Most of them don't have a dens developed, so there is a complete lack of a process that protrudes in this area, or they have a very, very small dens. Then others have a developed dens, but it may be crooked, it may be deviating laterally or dorsally. Very rarely, it's really quite an unusual situation, you would have a fracture of a dens and due to that instability. The other proposed mechanism is that you have a primary ligament abnormality. And I would say while this is certainly possible, when you read a little bit in the literature, and then also if you have experience with these cases and you do imaging, they certainly have ligament abnormalities, but they're in conjunction with a deformed bony structure. I remember when I was still in training, there was a proposition that maybe collagen deficiency, you know, weak collagen would stretch the ligaments, and that would allow this joint to become unstable. This is not really supported anymore, because other parts, other ligaments would then need to show a similar deficiency, and that has just not been supported. So it is certainly out there, that theory, but what we do know for a fact is that the bone conformation plays a huge role and is probably the most important aspect of this. This image here, this illustration, demonstrates for me quite nicely what happens when you have instability in this joint. So if you look at the image on the left, we see, of course, overshadowed by C1, we see the dense, this process of C2 lying on the floor of the canal, really overlapped by C1. And everything is well aligned. The canal is aligned. The spinal cord can travel through, and there is no compression. Then if you look at the image on the right, we have an abnormal dense. The dense is too short. With that, of course, we have a ligament detachment and ligament stability that is not normal. So this dense can often not be supported by the abnormally developed ligaments or stretched out ligaments due to this repetitive motion. And then we get a subluxation. And the subluxation due to the weight of the head will occur such that the head will drop down, and this joint will flex. And flexion of this joint will unfortunately bring the dense up into the spinal cord. So we have a displacement of the dense into the canal, and with that, a compression of the spinal cord. And you can imagine that that can be life-threatening. If this happens acutely and severely, such animals could potentially die from it. Most of the time, they fortunately don't. They're quite affected, but they have tremendous clinical signs. It also makes sense that if an animal has instability and has a fairly normal developed dense, or, you know, pretty large dense, then that compression will be worse. So in some ways, for the little toy breed dog, it may be better if that dog is born without a dense and doesn't develop a dense, because then at least we don't have that bone compression through on the spinal cord. The other pretty amazing thing is this happens with most of the time no significant traumatic event. So these are dogs that just go on about their daily business. They do normal activities, and they probably start a certain degree of instability, and then all of a sudden they reach that threshold, and then things stretch, and then they subluxate. So most of the time, no history of trauma. Then they present to you. They often come with a history of screaming in pain and having one event, one moment where suddenly they become extremely painful. They may show gait abnormalities that the owner has already identified, and they may not be able to ambulate at all. So that would be the worst thing. For you on your neurologic exam, we would expect to find a cranial cervical lesion. So peripheral deficits that would be typical for a C1 to C5 myelopathy. That typically means that these dogs will have upper motor neuron signs to all four limbs. So that means good muscle tone, good reflexes, you know, all the peripheral functions as far as the reflexes are concerned are there. But they may have ataxia, they may show weakness to their limbs, and fortunately a very small percent of animals come in with true loss of motor. So most of them show neck pain, and this can be in addition, of course, to ataxia and weakness. And then about a little more than half of these dogs will show incoordination and weakness, and fortunately very few will show complete loss of motor. If you remember, when we have a cervical lesion that is this bad that it causes plegia, so loss of motor to all legs, it will also cause loss of motor to your respiratory muscles. And this particular problem is so high up that even the phrenic nerve will be affected. So these dogs, if they truly are plegic, I mean, if this is a complete loss of any motor function, then they will have no respiratory function, and those are the ones that don't make it to you. They will die, or they will be agonal when they come to you. So yes, they can be this severe. Fortunately, it is not the typical presentation. So now we're going to show a quick video. This is a pretty typical dog, a young Pomeranian. She presented after she had been to the groomer. That was a very common history where I used to work. I don't know if it had something to do with the way they were latched onto the table. You see, this dog is really guarding her neck. She's not walking normally. She is a little ataxic when she was just taking a few steps. But the key thing for me is for you to see that this dog has a lot of pain. She's really splinting her neck muscles. She's looking a lot with her eyes, or turns her entire body around in order to see. And doesn't really want to move a lot. So hallmark of AA instability is really tremendous, tremendous cervical pain, and with that, some degree of ataxia. So here I left the volume on purpose, because you see I am supporting her and I'm just testing her proprioception. And she is screaming in pain, because even though I'm not touching her neck, she is not a big fan of what I'm doing there. Doing a neurologic exam on a dog that is this obviously painful can be quite challenging. You can still do a lot of things. sorry. And you have to. You're in this situation where part of you, of course, hates doing that, and part of you doesn't want to do that. But you really need to obtain the information for that particular patient. Why do we need to do that? Well, it could be something else, right? I mean, at this point, we don't know if this dog has an atlantoaxial instability, or has a ruptured disc, or has some other form of trauma. And while we want to be as gentle as we can, not cause more damage and not cause a tremendous amount of pain, even though it didn't look like this, we still must assess the actual neurologic function. And if during your exam you decide you can't do certain things because it wouldn't be good for the patient, then that's perfectly all right. But always try to judge, you know, what do you really need to get out of this? For this dog, we knew this dog was able to walk, but I really needed to find out if she could do the knuckling test, if she had proprioceptive deficits, and we did this by doing knuckling with her, and by doing hopping with her, which is another method of assessing a proprioception. And then we did lay her down and very carefully got reflexes performed on the limbs. Now, certainly when you have a dog like this, that's actually one of the questions right now, you know, you don't have to assess neck pain. You know this dog is extremely painful in the neck. I will be the last one to then go and do range of motion on a dog like this, or do deep spinal palpation. But the key thing for me is they're challenging, they're small, they tend to be extremely painful. But you just need to be brave and go into a quiet corner, maybe without the owner present, and you very carefully do as best as you can with obtaining a neurologic exam. But for me, this dog is a very, very good example of what these dogs look like. They're very, very challenging, and you know, your heart goes out, because they're just really in bad shape. What are differentials? There are actually quite a number of differentials that are important. First of all, cervical disc extrusion. And even though you will mostly see atlantoaxial instability in young dogs, you still have the potential for disc extrusions even in that population. Yes, we see them when they're typically a little bit older, but you cannot disregard that. Then we will very briefly touch base on the Chiari-like malformations and syringomyelias. They're big complex of diseases that we have found more and more and more now that we're using MRI and advanced imaging. Before, when we'd used radiography or maybe myelography, it was extremely difficult to really appreciate abnormalities like that. And especially in the toy small breed dogs, they have a very, very high rate of having concurrently these anomalies or anomalies that are the primary reason for pain. Of course, small breed dogs, toy breed dogs are also very good candidates for inflammatory brain disease, and that can cause headaches, it can cause cervical pain, maybe not quite to this extent, but at the end of the day, you just don't know. And you also need to be careful with true primary brain disease, intracranial disease, because even that can give you head pain and cervical pain that may look very similar. Of course, then we always have trauma that should be on our differential list. And in some way, AA instability, of course, is a form of trauma. Neoplasia, of course, you could argue that these are young dogs, but you may have all seen young dogs with neoplasia, so you can never scratch it off your list. And then also differentials that are not very likely, but should be on the differential list are infections that can affect the bone, can affect the disc space, can even affect the meninges and the spinal cord. But one of the examples now would be discospondylitis. Coming on now to diagnostic imaging, radiographs would absolutely, for me, be the first choice modality of imaging. We will talk why, for us now, advanced imaging is indicated in these dogs, but as your first choice test, a radiograph is still going to give you a great amount of information. Whenever you have a dog like this where you're unsure and AA instability is on your differential list, start with a lateral view. That is, for the animal, the safest view. It shows you the alignment of the area the best, and it can at least give you a very good impression right away whether there is an obvious subluxation or alignment appears normal. And if it appears normal, then at least you can take a breather and say, okay, you know, this is not going to disconnect while I'm manipulating this dog for radiographs. CT has fantastic bone detail, and that is the main benefit of CT. It gives you great, great amount of information for surgical planning. In the image on the right, that is the example, you see almost a telescoping of the dens and of C2 into C1, and that can be a popular way of how these will present on a CT. MRI, as you know, is the most wonderful imaging test for soft tissues. So in particular, if you want to look at other diseases, is there fluid accumulation in the spinal cord? Is there hydrocephalus? Is there, is there any other evidence that I have disease other than my bony anomaly with this instability? Then an MRI is really the test to do. Myelography for this particular condition should best be avoided. Myelography can cause temporary worsening in an area of inflammation along the spine, which this far cervical may not be desired. Also, to not damage further this area, you would have to do a lumbar injection, which a lot of people are not comfortable with. If myelography in your hands is what you have, and that is what you routinely do, then I think, you know, you can do that, but you must do a lumbar injection. And again, the shortcoming is, like with x-ray, you will not see the changes in the parenchyma and you will miss a lot of concurrent diseases. So here are different views. In the top left, we have a normal alignment. What you look for, I'm going to use the little arrow button here. You look for the lamina of C1. And that will be the dorsal portion of the spinal canal. And then when you look at C2, you can also make out the dorsal border of the spinal canal. And these lines should be pretty parallel. You can also look at the space between the C1 lamina and the spinous process of C2. And there, it's normal for there to be a gap. But if there is a gap so large that you can stick your head through, then you know, whoa, there is something that is probably not normal. So on your next radiographs unrelated to AA instability, just look at that, you know, just take a look at the area and get a feel for it. It's not an area that we routinely evaluate. In the image down below, you can see that space is very, very large. You can also see that the general alignment of the spinal canal cranially and caudally to that are not the same. On the VD view, that is the best view to see the dents, to see if there is a dent. And again, I can only encourage you, it's really quite fun on all your next x-rays where you have that part of the anatomy, just look for the dents, you know, go find it and then tell somebody, hey, look, there's the dents and I can now see it. It should be right here in the middle of C2 protruding forward. So this is in a dog, this is a radiograph of a dog that has a agenesis of the dents. This dog has no dents and subsequently developed AA instability. Here again, the alignment lines, if the space between the lamina and the spinous process, that's not, you know, it's not the most objective way to assess it, then mentally or really with a pencil, draw in lines or on a computer program, and you can see how these lines divert. They're not in the same direction. You can tell as objectively as possible on an x-ray that this dog has a malalignment and has a subluxation at this space. What we will avoid and really try to avoid at all cost is ventriflexion. One thing that often is asked is, should we sedate these dogs? Should we do this under anesthesia? Should we do it awake? I think getting a decent radiograph with an animal that is this painful in an awake setting is probably not very realistic. The struggling that will occur probably has a higher potential to do damage and to cause harm. So what I would do in a situation like that, I would always provide some form of sedation, you know, just enough to, you know, provide pain control, analgesia, and settle them down so that they're manageable. And when they're sedated or even when they're anesthetized, you just need to take the precaution of not manipulating them too much. You know, have somebody, you know, educate your staff or do it yourself where really the head is supported, the neck is supported, and where, you know, it doesn't flop off the edge of the table, and you're just making sure that neck does not get flexed more. We do dynamic views, and with that flexion extension views in other parts of the spine, and that is, you know, not always great, but we do it for a purpose because it is so difficult to see a dynamic problem. In this case, you really don't want to do that. If you need to see the dents better on a lateral view, what you can do is just slightly turn the head obliquely, and that will get rid of the wings, the overlapping wings, and kind of protrude out the dents on the radiographs a little bit better. So general answer to the question, should we do dynamic views, is no. Of course, there will always be exceptions. They're very rare exceptions. And one exception in my mind would be if you suspected AA instability, you take your lateral radiograph and everything appears to be aligned normally. And then you go, I really thought this was unstable. In that case, I have done this as well. I have, under very controlled circumstances, taken that head and flexed it ever so slightly, taken another radiograph. If that looked normal, flexed it a little bit more, taken another radiograph, so that you're doing it in a controlled manner, but you are stressing that joint just to see if maybe there is instability as you proceed in this flexion. That is best done with continuous radiography, so with some form of fluoroscopy, so that you can see as you're moving it. And again, very, very small motions, and, you know, just be prepared that this is something that you really want to do yourself. You don't want to tell somebody, hey, can you just get me a flex view of this animal? I know it's tough when you're in practice and, you know, specialists keep telling everybody, oh, this needs a CT and this needs an MRI, because you may not have CT and you may not have MRI. I think there are lots of things, lots of information we can gain from radiographs. And I think even in this particular problem is fantastic for radiographs, because overall you can see whether there is a subluxation in almost every case using a radiograph. Reason to use an MRI is for all the other things that can happen. It is unbelievable how often, now that we use MRI, we find additional anomalies. And mainly, we're finding what is listed here towards the end of these points, the occipital and lanto-occipital anomalies. There's a very nice publication if any of you are interested. There's just such a huge array of anomalies that we never saw on an X-ray. So here you have a Chihuahua. It's a young dog. It comes in for concern for atlanto-axial instability, and then you do an X-ray, and let's say on the X-ray everything actually looks like atlanto-axial instability. You do surgery on this dog, and you do it really well. Surgery goes great, and the healing is great. Implants stay in place, and the dog comes back or just remains neurologic. The dog remains painful, and the dog still can't walk, is still terribly ataxic. And then, of course, you assume that you did something wrong. And I was trained still before we did MRIs and everything, and it was so frustrating because you just never knew why these dogs weren't doing well. So when you look at this MRI, I realize, you know, assessing MRIs may not be something that you do often, but what we want to see is this kind of light gray shading for spinal cord. So in the spinal canal, we should see this color of gray in this canal here. On this particular sequence, fluid comes up as white. So we see the hydrated nuclei down in the cervical spine. We see that this dog actually has a hydrocephalus. There's too much fluid in the ventricle. We see the gyri. We see the cerebellum. We see really awesome detail here. We see that there is bone encroaching into the area of the cerebellum. So this dog actually had a Chiari-like malformation and was compressing the cerebellum. But what is more important is that there is a dorsal compression by bone, and that is not typical for AA instability. And even more horrifically is that there is hardly any more spinal cord. This is all fluid. This is a huge, huge tunnel of fluid, with the only remnant of spinal cord being all this little thing down here and probably all around. So this dog had a severe, severe syringohydromyelia, fluid accumulation within the spinal cord, with just this tiny, tiny little rim in the periphery of remaining spinal cord. And this, you may have been able to notice something really weird on a myelogram, but this is just not something you would see on your typical imaging using radiographs. You won't even see this using a CT. And If you do surgery or perform treatment for AA instability on a dog like this, then you're bound to have a very poor outcome, not because you did anything wrong for the AA instability, but because this dog has a multitude of other problems. That is the reason why we very routinely now perform MRI, because it's just unbelievable how many dogs have concurrent other significant anomalies. CSF analysis, yes, it is important, just from a principle that, of course, we don't know until we have a clean CSF analysis whether there also is an inflammatory component. Like I said earlier, a lot of these toy breed dogs have inflammatory diseases that can be very severe. They can be necrotizing and cause a, very early death in patients. So it's always this question, do we need this and where do we get it from? Because, of course, the traditional positioning for a cisternal tap is contraindicated if you are concerned about AA instability. So if you really need to get a CSF analysis, then you must do a lumbar puncture. You cannot do a cranial cervical puncture. And then, just do it with the extra challenge because it's not as easy to obtain it there. So on to treatment. Of course, they don't develop these clinical signs slowly. They usually get to a point where they still manage to hang on to their stability, and then they reach the threshold and then everything just falls to pieces. So it tends to be an acute presentation of pain and of neurologic deficits. So up and foremost, we're trying to protect the spinal cord from further injury. And it is pretty amazing because, you think of that and you go, wow, this is just moving back and forth and back and forth, that we can treat this conservatively. Of course, it makes sense to do it surgically, but we can treat it conservatively. Traditionally, this was reserved for dogs that were ambulating quite well and that had manageable pain. And that means that you could give the medication, they responded to the medication, and the pain may not have been gone entirely, but it was at least gone to a point where you felt pretty good about yourself. And then surgical treatment was reserved to the ones that were much worse neurologically or had just pain that couldn't be treated appropriately, certainly for the ones that had respiratory compromise or that got worse with conservative therapy. There is one study that was done, and of course it didn't include thousands of dogs, it included a small number of dogs, but still it's the only study out there that also had conservative management with some form of splinting for dogs that were non-ambulatory. And I do think that you have that choice of conservative managements even when the dogs are neurologically worse. And that is supported by the literature, if not by many studies, but you have that option. I'm going to start with surgical management because then at the end of the presentation, that's when we'll talk about the splint, and I felt that we could put everything together with conservative management then. So surgical management, you have an unstable joint. Of course, the goal is we want to stabilize it. Ideally, we would love to stabilize it so that it never, ever, ever becomes unstable by obtaining some form of arthrodesis. And I'll get to that in a second. Generally, we have different approaches. We can come from dorsal, and we can come from ventral, and we can combine them. And depending on which procedure you pick, and also from which era the publications are, the mortality rates have been described to actually up to 50%, more recently much lower, so average about 30%, and also quite a high implant failure rate. And that made, in the past, the surgical management of AA instability very unattractive, even for surgeons. I mean, I remember telling people, telling owners before surgery that their dog had a 50-50 chance of surviving surgery. And I mean, that's terrible. That's not something, that's not a surgery I would enjoy doing. So as we go on, we'll realize that some procedures appear to be better than others, just in regards to the complications and also in what we try to achieve with them. There is some just interesting. There are some interesting points about what may affect the outcome with surgery. It seems that dogs that are younger do better, which I, you know, makes sense to me. And of course, what makes perfect sense is dogs do better if they are less affected neurologically. One thing that I find a little interesting, and it's one of those typical things where you do statistics and you come up with a result and it's maybe not clinically relevant, is when signs were present less than 10 months. So hopefully we won't wait 10 months, but of course when they're younger, signs haven't been there for as long, and if they're not affected as badly, those are always going to be in your favor if you decide to recommend surgery. We're going to go through the surgical procedures fairly quickly, just so that you have an idea. There are a number of dorsal stabilization procedures. Most of them will either include a wire or a suture that is looped through the canal and around C1 and is then anchored to the spinous process of C2. There are descriptions where you can take the nuchal ligament. And again, just a reminder, the nuchal ligament originates from the caudal aspect of the spinous process of C2. And then if you take that and transpose it to the lamina of C1, in theory, that would help protect against ventral subluxation. And then there is a Kishigami retractor, which was popular at one point in people. Has kind of got a revival recently. Older publications judge this group of stabilization procedures as the one that has the highest failure rate. And one of the reasons is that that bone up there, the spinous process bone, imagine these are toy breeds, right? These are tiny, tiny dogs. You can look, you can see the light through that bone. These implants often break through, and of course then you don't have stability anymore. So most literature will tell you that that's not the first choice. In the end, this is patient specific. There may be the perfect patient to do this, and then these are very acceptable techniques. Here's some images on a bone model. It's always great to do it on a bone model. Drill a couple of holes through the spinous process of C2, and then you loop your wire through without damaging the spinal cord, and then you fix it. Kishigami retractor, you can see on the radiographs and on this image above kind of what the idea there is. It's a metal implant that has a smooth hook that hooks under the lamina and then has these little connecting arms that go to the side of the spinous process. And again, the goal is to prevent ventral subluxation of the joint. Lots of complications do occur with the dorsal fixation. And in the end, one of the concerns is you rely really on scar tissue formation and you're not getting a permanent stability through arthrodesis. That is the goal of most ventral fixation techniques, because if we go ventrally, we have access to those big facets, to those big joints, and we can actually get some of the cartilage away, put bone graft in there, and then fix it, and hopefully really get good bone fusion there so that that problem is resolved once and for all. We have a variety of techniques. We have the very first techniques that were described, the older ones. They're, you know, perfectly fine from the principle. And from the theory, this is a cross-pinning technique. You just take smooth Kirschner wires or small Steinman pins if you have a large dog, and you place them through the articulation, really transarticularly, one on each side. Unfortunately, if you only do this, this technique is fraught really with a pretty high failure rate, and also, unfortunately, in the older publications with a high mortality rate. So I do not recommend this anymore, and I do not perform this anymore. The next step up from that, the next development, was to use screws instead of pins. One problem with the pins were that they would migrate and just come out. And screws, of course, with the threads, they can hold on to it a little bit better. The struggle is you can't position these screws very well because of your access to this area. And especially in a toy breed, they're an incredibly small amount of bone. And what often happens is that you place the screws and either immediately they break through one of the bones so that they lose fixation, or you place one well and then while you place the other, the first one already fails. So it's a great concept, you know, and you could even provide compression if you place them in a lag fashion, but the reality is that this also has quite a high failure rate. Here's a post-op image of a dog that had screw fixation, and when you look at this, the alignment of the spine is perfect. I mean, you can't align it any better. We have the dorsal lamina of C1. We have the roof of the spinal canal of C2. If you drew lines there, I mean, they would be perfectly parallel. The space between the spinous process and the lamina is essentially gone. And our implants right now, you know, they're stable. They look like they're going into the canal, but we're missing the second view. So we just have to assume that on the second view, you could see that they're diverging away from the canal. And if you see this, then post-operatively, you can be extremely excited and stoked that you've done a really, really good job. Unfortunately, I've done this and I've seen it in really, really great hands, and you come back 4 weeks later and the screws have broken and have migrated, and then of course you don't feel so good about yourself anymore. So then this developed further and evolved into using fixation not directly across the joint, but doing it like we do with fracture fixation. We go above and we go below. And then we try to somehow bond these two areas together. And that is called multiple implant fixation. So you can take screws, people take wires, and then they use mostly bone cement, PMMA, to bond this together. And there have been a number of different techniques described in the last 10 years, and they by far, what is in the literature, have the best success rate at this point. So, you know, on that basis, it really has become the recommended technique. Again, here's just more the illustration, gives you an idea of how. So we're placing screws. It doesn't really matter where, as long as they're safe screws and they can hang on to you know, a bit of bone, in C1 and in C2. In both these examples, little K wires were used to reinforce as reinforcement bars, and then that construct then is covered with a small amount of bone cement to hold everything together. This is the technique that I perform as well, with the exception that I don't use these rebars, I don't use the reinforcement bars. I place four screws, one on each side of the articulation, left and right, in the thickest part of that facet bone, and then use a small amount of bone cement to bond these together. This is intraoperative use. You can see this space right here, here, and on the other side, that is the articular space. And we have gone in there already with a curette and curetted very carefully the cartilage out. And we used I use a little dental hook to just reduce that joint. On the middle image, you can see there's a bunch of cancellous bone graft placed into that area. And there are these four screws already. And then a small amount of bone cement that is placed on top. Works well for me. I'm not going to tell you that I have hundreds of dogs that I've done this on, because fortunately we don't see hundreds of dogs for this. But it's, you know, whatever technique you may use or may you may see with these multiple implants, they tend to work quite well. It's really exciting to see new implants being developed. This one is specifically for the atlantoaxial joint that you also place ventrally, where we can do an arthrodesis. And here they're trying to, instead of having this bone cement in there, still get multiple implants in, and with that little clamp plate, maintain reduction with those small screws. So we'll see how this works out clinically. So far, it's only been tested biomechanically. Even there, with the ventral fixation, even with multiple implants, you can have complications, of course. There are big vessels that you have to work around. You have an approach that has to go past the trachea. So if you're not careful, you can damage the trachea. Intraoperatively, there is still a possibility that these animals arrest on you and die. Not really, mostly because you drilled into the canal or you caused hemorrhage. We sometimes don't understand why they did this, whether it's reperfusion or ischemia within that section of the cord or a clot that is thrown within the parenchyma. We just don't know. But there certainly are still big complications that can happen that you need to warn owners about. Post-op management, respiratory function is the most important one. Once they, you know, are good with breathing, yeah, they show good motor function, and they're reasonably comfortable, then, I mean, you're golden, and you're already really, really happy. Conservative management now. So it's a tough one. It's you know, you have overt instability. I mean, you know this thing is unstable. So what are we trying to achieve with conservative management? It's like a knee with a torn cruciate. If you're doing conservative management, you are not expecting that knee will ever go back into a normal position and ever become stable again as it was before. And we're not going to assume this here either. So when we put these dogs in a splint or in a bandage or put them in a cage for 2 months, all we're really trying to achieve is that the swelling from that acute trauma will go down, and that already gives them a great amount of improvement, and that maybe we can get fibrosis around this joint so that the movement won't be so bad. What we cannot assume, and we will kid ourselves if we think this, is that joint will, you know, we'll put it back into alignment, and then the fibrosis will keep it back in alignment, and then it'll stay, you know, in a more or less normal position. That's not going to happen. We can't get it back into alignment with just a splint. If we do this, and again, it works, it can work really, really well in some dogs, then owners must realize that this could happen again, and that they really should employ permanent lifestyle changes to try to reduce the risk of this occurring again a little bit, you know, as far as they can. So no neck lead, trying to avoid, you know, tug of war plays and, you know, jumping from great heights and the typical things. Fortunately, they're toy breeds. They're mostly carried around anyways, but maybe they need to carry them around differently. Cervical splints, especially when this acute phase is happening and they're very painful, you know, you have the screaming dog, everybody is scared of touching them. It's an acute injury. And if we can provide some external cooptation, then on principle, that should help with swelling and reducing the pain. The main key there is that you really need to think of a bandage that effectively immobilizes the neck. And if you think of that very first image with the fulcrum, with the whole cervical spine and then this big head hanging in the front and then everything centering on C1 and C2, that is now unstable. It won't often be enough to just put a little bit of cotton around the neck and, you know, and say, I've immobilized the neck now. If you're really trying to immobilize, we need to do this appropriately. So traditional bandages, even if they included, long splints and really went from the nose down to the sternum, the way I remember putting them on were always under general anesthesia. And then you just put a big soft pad of bandage on, included your splints, and in the end, the dogs looked like in the movie What About Mary? You know, they couldn't move, they couldn't do anything. I've had many dogs where the bandage had to be removed upon recovery of anesthesia because they couldn't breathe. They had, tremendous respiratory compromise. The bandage was very restrictive. They were extremely stressed. And then this combination just wasn't tolerated. The other problem is when you have such a big soft pad of bandage, just like on a limb, you don't really know what's going on underneath. And these are some clinical images from the time where we were still doing the traditional bandages. In the picture top right, there the splint portion had slipped out and the cotton had slipped back a little bit, and then the dog developed full thickness pressure sores down to the mandibular bone on both sides from that splint pressure. Now that was, it's a technical mistake. It was meant well because the bandage, they didn't want to put the bandage too far rostral because wanted the dog to still be able to, get to its food bowl. But you need to be extremely careful when you use splints that doesn't happen. On the image below, this dog had a very large traditional bandage on and was fed a lot of liquid food, and a lot of the food then, unbeknownst to the owner, would leak down into the bandage and caused this very, very severe dermatitis and just really nasty wound on the sternum. So just like with limb bandages, you have to be very, very careful and think about primarily respiratory function and then skin issues underneath, abrasions, pressure sores. You need to be careful about the eyes, that the bandage doesn't cause corneal abrasions. And you also need to, in the very, very, very back of your mind, know that this could also cause the death of this animal. Maybe not the bandage, but the combination of the bandage with the disease. It is not something that benign that we just put on. So I had a very difficult case in that time where the traditional bandage wouldn't work, and that then ultimately made me go to an extremely simplified bandage and splint. And that's what I want to share with you. The great thing and fun thing is you have all the tools. If you have a little bit of imagination, you can change this. You can use other materials. Just try out new things. The principle remains the same. We want to have effective immobilization. But the way we're putting the splint on now is just extremely, extremely simple with very little material, which allows us to maintain it very easily and change it without a lot of issues. So what do you need? You need some casting tape, casting material, some stockinette. Usually this is made out of cotton, some just regular tape, scissors, some paper towels, and a cast saw. And with this casting tape, if you're familiar with it, it's quite sticky. And if it gets on your hands, then you won't get it off for weeks. So wear gloves when you use it. The idea is now to make two splints that are custom made for that particular patient. You want a dorsal splint and a ventral splint. To make this, it is extremely beneficial to have the animal be anesthetized. So I will do them immediately after they've had their imaging or their surgery or whatever made them be under anesthesia. And if I don't need the splint for very long, then I just chuck it. It's not that expensive. So under anesthesia, we start with the dog in dorsal recumbency, as you see on the left. So that's kind of the safe body position. And I'm unrolling the casting tape, and the head is quite extended. I'm going to let this dry and harden after I wet it with water. You see I put a paper towel on the dog so that it doesn't stick to the dog skin. Then when that is dry and hard, I actually already leave it on the dog, flip the dog over, and then do my dorsal splint. The ventral splint goes from even rostral to the mandible. So I go beyond the mandible to back to the end of the sternum. The dorsal splint goes and cups the cranium and really goes almost to the level of the eyes or beyond the level of the eyes, and then goes as far back as the ventral splint. So these splints are quite long rostrally. You can always shorten them later. It's not easy to make them longer, so rather make them longer right from the beginning. When you're happy with how the splints look, I often cut out little areas for the ventral splints so that the arms won't rub so badly. And you can see this on the image on the left bottom here, the little cutout areas, that is the ventral splint. For the toy breed dogs, they have, so many of them have this dome head, so you really, almost like a spoon, this is the part that the head goes in. And then I've also learned that it helps to put water-resistant tape around the splint, because of course when these dogs are fed water and food, it will go and you know, get messy. And at least when this, especially the ventral splint, is covered in tape, it won't mess up the splint so badly. Then you take your stockinette, you fold it over twice. You can even fold it over three times, but twice should be enough. You cut holes for the legs in the middle, and then you slip it on like a onesie, like a little baby shirt, and make sure that the stockinette is long enough that to cover all the splints. And then you very simply, into the space that the double layer of the stockinette has provided, slide in your splints. Now, at this point, this is not stable. We still need to, you know, get this to really be grasping the dog and not allowing the dog much movement. But now we have, through the stockinette, allowed the splints to be somewhere in position. I've also learned through experience to put some tape on the stockinette under the chin. It gives you a draining board of sorts to better clean. And as you see on the top right image, I use tape to pull the stockinette back from the eyes, because otherwise the stockinette will be really, really rostral. You cut small holes into the stockinette for the ears. Obviously, be careful that you don't cut the ears. And then the crucial step is that with an assistant, you really make sure that you clamshell the animal in those custom-made splints that fit this animal very well, and you place three rounds of tape, one in front of the ears to hold the head, one behind the ears, and then one at the end of the splints over the chest. You don't have to squeeze as hard as you can. It really is just a matter of, you know, just capturing the dog in there and not allowing movement, especially of the head, even to the left and right. So if this thing is loose and the dog can turn and rotate and look to the left and right, then you need to snug those tapes up again. Splint care afterwards. I've only done this particular splint in the toy breeds, and I think realistically that's most of the time where we see AA instability. For large breed dogs, you may, you know, I'm actually not sure if this would work with the stockinette in this regard. But for the little ones, they do need to be fed. They need to be given water. They cannot bend their head. That's the whole point of this. It's really that we're trying to keep this as immobile as is humanly possible. Most owners of these dog breeds love it. They think it's perfect because these are, you know, their little babies. It helps putting a little paper towel underneath. You know, I mean, there are lots of things that you can do to help keep this reasonably clean. In the beginning, you may have to change this bandage maybe even daily, every other day or so, until the dog gets used to it, the owners get used to it, you get used to it, it doesn't get so dirty anymore. And once everybody gets the hang of it, you change it maybe once a week for the duration that you need to. The other wonderful thing is, at least for us, when we did this, we had a row of lots of those, we did not have to sedate these dogs anymore. You very carefully cut the stockinette off at the side. You have the next one ready. You carefully slip it on, slip the splints in, put the tape on. So none of that putting under anesthesia for a cumbersome soft padded bandage. This is often what the stockinet will look like. It looks a little yucky and gross. They often get some dermatitis under their chin. I've also started just shaving the hair in that area preemptively, just from the get-go, again, just for maintenance. But I have to say, I will never go back to the traditional bandages on the toy breeds, because this has worked out so well and is really something that I mean, almost anybody can do. You know, just be mindful of the conformation of the animals, and of course, be mindful of breathing and things pinching and rubbing, and then you may have to adjust, but you can adjust these so well, and I'd be excited if any one of you uses them. Then let me know, send me a picture or something. That would be tremendous. So, and I think we're heading towards the end now. So prognosis with surgery. It's always funny when textbooks tell you if the animal survives, the prognosis is good. but yeah, that's true here as well. I mean, there is still a risk, even with the best surgeon and you know, the best circumstances. This is a pretty serious condition and a difficult, challenging surgery. But with the newer techniques, I think we do most of the time have a good outcome. And the goal there is that the pain is resolved. Animals may still have some neurologic deficits just simply from the initial trauma, but hopefully that improves back to as much as possible, if not normal. Consider the age at onset and how long the clinical signs are as prognostic indicators. And of course, if you have a patient like this and you're trying conservative management, then just be mindful, if that doesn't work, that we don't want to drag this out a long time, that we then want to be proactive and just get on with it. and that with conservative therapy, even with animals that do have significant disease, it appears to be okay. But just that we're all clear on what we're expecting it to do, really just reduce the inflammation and put down some fibrous tissue, but not that it's a rigid, solid fixation. Other highlights, probably for me as an, you know, the non-surgical part is really the imaging, that for our prognosis. I think this is why also nowadays in publications the prognosis is better, because we are using other modalities. We're selecting differently for the patients that we take to surgery. That 30 years ago, you know, they had surgery and they may have died, and they may not have died from the AA, but from something else. I would be excited if the splinting was something that is useful for you. Maybe you may use it for other things. And like I said, if you want to give feedback on that, then certainly feel free. And with that, we have come to the conclusion, and I appreciate that you have listened so attentively, and thank you so much.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Bianca for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.